The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's discussion, we are going to be discussing some of the recent news in the Bitcoin space, and in particular, beginning with the recent round of number go up, what it tells us about Bitcoin's technology, how it's been working, and also what it means for Bitcoin skeptics and haters. And we're also going to be discussing the announcement today by the USOCC, the US Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, on the use of digital currencies for settlement between banks, and how this relates to my book, The Bitcoin Standard. So first of all, I wanted to begin with Roubini, Nouriel Roubini, who this week climbed out of his cave in order to inform the world with much glee that Bitcoin's price had tumbled by over 15% from 34 to 29,000 in 24 hours on a Sunday without any news. So let me share the tweet that he had here. He's
Yeah, and he argues this is a total irrational bubble on a pseudo asset with zero intrinsic or fundamental value that is totally manipulated via fiat tethered daily issuance, massive pump and dump schemes, and whales. And so it's quite amazing when you think about it that this guy looks at the fact that this thing crashes to 29,000, which is the level that is roughly four times where it was exactly 1 year ago. He argues that this is a totally irrational bubble. And this is in my mind, one of the amazing ways in which the academic brain malfunctions, which is that when a normal intelligent human being, and that really, or not even intelligent, you know, even the average human being, when they think of something and they can't make sense of it, they would likely conclude that, you know, I don't understand it. I'm not being able to understand it properly. But education has the debilitating effect of creating people like Rubini who, when they don't understand something, respond with aggressive and hostile attack against it because, you know, clearly this thing is irrational and clearly it does not make sense. Clearly, it has zero value, and clearly nobody should be holding this because I can't make sense of it. And, you know, and if I, with all of my degrees and, you know, fiat university jobs, if I cannot make sense of this thing, then clearly it's nothing. It's an amazing testament to the human mind that they managed to convince themselves of these kind of mental tricks. And you know, the interesting thing about it for me is how Rubini is not new to this game. If we look at this exact sentiment has been something that Rubini has been practicing since April 2013, where he was saying in a tweet, he said, I think he retweeted somebody who said, while everyone was focused on gold and silver, Bitcoin dropped another 40%, traded below $58. And so there he is, you know, he knew about Bitcoin at $58. He could have bought a whole Bitcoin at $58. And today that whole Bitcoin would have been worth $29,000, would have crashed to a price of $29,000, which is funnily enough, exactly 500 times the number in this. So, you know, 58 times 500 is 29,000. And that's the price to which we, I hope I'm doing the math right. If Pierre Rochard is listening, he'll correct me. I actually didn't prepare the math for this, so maybe my eyes are deceiving me, but I presume that's correct. In any case, so this is this irrational bubble that makes no sense to Rubini has now moved to crashing exactly 500 times higher than where it was. And he is still repeating the same record. You know, at 58, the fact that it dropped to $58 was, in his mind, enough to discredit Bitcoin. The fact that it rose back up to 5,000 and then 10,000 and 15,000 and now 29 does not redeem it. The fact that it falls from 34 to 29 is in itself discredits the entire enterprise. And in a sense, it's quite amazing that you would see an economist think in this way. The idea that the market is out there and Bitcoin is now grown to a market that is $500 billion. It is larger than basically the size of the market cap of Bitcoin is basically larger than all of the world's banks and all of the world's currencies except 15 currencies. Bitcoin is the 16th largest national currency in the world today on its 12th birthday. Yesterday was its 12th birthday. So the fact that Bitcoin has continued to succeed this much and continued to grow to this extent, I mean, Rubini worked with the IMF and he's advised some of the countries who have currencies that are now smaller than the value of the Bitcoin network. So you've got entire nation states that have been at the government money business for decades or centuries or maybe millennia, whose currencies are worth less than the value of the Bitcoin network at this point. And so it's really at this point, I think my question to all the no-coiners, if you look here, see these charts, Bitcoin basically at, before this last crash, it had become bigger than, even after the crash, I think, it's bigger than JP Morgan Chase, than ICBC, than Bank of America, than all of the world's banks, and it is bigger than all but 15 of the world's currencies. There are only 15 national currencies that are bigger than Bitcoin. So that's really not a mean achievement. And in my mind, it brings to focus the real important question here, which is Bitcoin's price is not a speculative bubble. It's not an irrelevant metric in a speculative bubble. Bitcoin's price is basically the most important metric for Bitcoin success. There's really no more important metric for what Bitcoin is doing, no better measure for Bitcoin success than whether its price is going up or down. Really, this is, a lot of people like to discuss it as if it's a lot of people like to say, well, you know, the price doesn't matter, that this is about the technology. The only technology here is the price. The only technology in Bitcoin is the price. It's not the only technology, but it's an essential component without which the whole thing falls apart. The price needs to be there. There has to be a market price for Bitcoin or Bitcoin doesn't matter. And if there is a market price, the higher the market price, the more secure the network from purely operational security aspect of you. You want the network to be more secure. If you want the network to be more secure, then you enjoy the fact that the price is higher. But also from an economic factor, from an economic view, in my mind, Bitcoin's adoption, the best measure of Bitcoin adoption is the total size of cash balances that exist in Bitcoin, which is effectively all the things that are being held by people, all the cash balances held by people in Bitcoin. So everybody in the world that is holding Bitcoin is what is giving it value. And the more people hold Bitcoin, the more the value goes up. And this is essentially what money is in the market. Money is held as a cash balance. It's something that Keynesian economists and macroeconomists don't discuss. Like cash balances are not something that is important because in their bizarre world, people should hold government bonds and only a small amount of money in a checking account. And so, you know, you don't hold a lot of money in a checking account or in a saving account because these things don't offer good returns and you don't want your cash to fail to keep up with inflation. And so in order to keep up with inflation, you put your money in the government bonds. And so, you know, inflation is not a problem. You just buy government bonds. At least that's how the playbook had ran for years. But Bitcoin is offering an alternative to all of these financial assets in your portfolio. And you can't say that the price doesn't matter. You can't just, you know, strut around like a little child on the playground, throwing a tantrum and saying, putting your fingers in your ears and saying, I don't want to hear it. The price doesn't matter. The price doesn't matter. I mean, of course you can. And you know, Krugman and Rubini and all of these people are proof positive that, you know, you can build a career out of throwing tantrums and closing your ears. And refusing to listen to any logic. But people who have been watching this, you know, people who think with an open mind, cannot just dismiss the fact that you've got a currency this big where people are willingly holding so much value. You know, we've got millionaires and billionaires all over the world deciding to hold it. And we've got normal people from all over the world holding it and holding significant quantities. So this isn't, you know, this isn't, we're no longer in 2012, 2013, when it was a small market cap and a few people here and there holding a small amount of money. Now it's much bigger. There's a total amount of about $500 billion of nominal value out there that somebody is holding. You know, somebody has private keys worth, or everybody has private keys worth $500 billion, and they're not selling them. Some of them are lost, but not all of them are lost. And we can argue about how much is lost, but it doesn't ultimately matter because, you know, whether it's 500 or 400, there's clearly hundreds of billions of dollars of value that's already parked in Bitcoin all over the world. And I think this is enormously important as an economic development because it is a form of asset that is available for people from all over the world without need to resort to government money and to central banks. It is an alternative that exists out there for central banks, and it's incredible the fact that it grows. And you can't just ignore the price. As I was tweeting earlier, as you see in this tweet, at a price under $1, Bitcoin is a completely inconsequential nothing. It's a network that's worth $20 million. It's a toy. It's a toy network worth $20 million. It's like digital Beanie Babies at that point. If, you know, you could maybe see promise in the monetary properties or so on, but you can't ask people to take it seriously when it is at that size. The fact that it has achieved that level of adoption just means that, you know, you've got 20 million nerds around the world who each have $1, or 20 nerds around the world who each have $1 million roughly, or somewhere in between, which is not that difficult to achieve and doesn't really give much confidence in the network. But at a price of $1 million, Bitcoin is worth more than all the US dollar money supply, the M1 supply. If Bitcoin is worth $1 million, then the total market value of all the Bitcoin held by anybody in the world is larger than the total market value of all the dollars held by anybody, which is a lot, which is not a joke. And the fact that Bitcoin can achieve that is, by any measure, by any reasonable measure, it is a success. There's no way that if you told Rubini in 2013, you told them that, let's say, in 2030, Bitcoin is going to be larger than the US dollar. If that were the case, would you admit that Bitcoin succeeds? Bitcoin is a success. There is no way that he would say, well, who knows? You know, he can be delusional. Let's not put reasonable words in his mouth. he doesn't... So he really doesn't inspire confidence. But by any reasonable measure, growing to a larger size than the US dollar is an impressive achievement. And doing it as an emergent market that is on the free market, as an emergent network on the free market, doesn't even have anybody controlling it, is truly incredible. So, you know, And it doesn't even, if you don't think 1 million is impressive enough, well, you know, at $100 million, if the price of a Bitcoin is $100 million, then most likely these are the death throes of the dollar, and the dollar has essentially become worthless, and Bitcoin is the only or predominant money in the world. So the price of Bitcoin cannot continue to go up infinitely without... without Bitcoin succeeding. I think this is how I would phrase it. If the price keeps going up, Bitcoin can't fail, because eventually it just takes over all investable assets and it becomes larger than everything out there. So there comes a point where it has to succeed based on price. And so my challenge to all the no coiners, well, I shouldn't say no coiners. I'd say the anti-coiners, the people who really, really are hateful of Bitcoin and don't want it to succeed. My challenge for them is to name a price at which they would say that Bitcoin is failing. At what price would they be able to do that? And I've asked this of Peter Schiff, of course, in the debate that I had with him. You can find it somewhere on Twitter, on YouTube. I've had a debate with him where, but it was It's clear he's well set on not making sense of the world, and he doesn't want to get this point that it is a market value. And he's clearly trying to really bend over backwards in order to try and accommodate this with an Austrian framework. But ultimately, I think the reason that he's playing this bitter no-coiner is that he's doing it as an advertisement for his gold business, because he gets so much more publicity and attention because of this than he would otherwise. He's just constantly repeating the same thing about Bitcoin. Well, yeah, Bitcoin went up to 5,000, but now it's going to crash. Well, it doesn't crash, goes up to 10, and then he says the same thing, and it doesn't, and then it doesn't matter. Whatever the number is, he's always willing to come up and say, well, it doesn't matter, and it's going to crash, and it's a bubble. And so all of these people really need to either set up a price, or just shut up. You can't continue to talk about Bitcoin without accepting that there is a price at which it has started working. And in 2015, Paul Krugman himself, let's listen to what he had to say about this. This is him in 2015.
Indeed. Paul, what is your opinion of disruptive digital currencies such as Bitcoin? Do they in any way refute the idea that a currency must be backed by a government?
Okay. At this point, Bitcoin is not looking too good. Money is a pretty amazing thing, right? That for the most part, why does a piece of green paper with a...
This is the typical Keynesian socialist hallucination stuff about money, that it's just, if we all wish hard enough, then it magically gives it value.
That president had value, and it's because other people think it has value and circulates. And we like, however, there is an anchor for our dollar bills, which is not gold. It is the fact that you can use it to pay taxes. And then you have somebody try and create Bitcoin, which is, there's nothing in the end. It's supposed to be purely self-fulfilling prophecy, purely levitating on itself, which is not impossible, but it's kind of unlikely. And I have to say, I think a lot of what has happened, Bitcoin looks it really is a bubble in multiple senses. It's a little bit of, apparently it's a technically sweet solution to a problem, but it's not clear that that problem is one that has much economic relevance. Certainly not a reason to hold that currency. It is there's a lot of libertarian ideology about it. I think so. People were looking for something, and they bought into it, and literally bought into it for a while. But it's now collapsed quite a way. So no, the idea that there's something fundamental. I mean, if you're looking for the idea that a currency doesn't really have to be something physical, it can be something that's virtual. That's the system we already have. And if you want it to be, I want a way to make payments electronically, that's, credit cards. I mean, and so exactly what it is that this thing is supposed to be doing that we don't already mostly do. I mean, there are technical differences, but pretty wild. I mean, yeah, we already have an amazingly abstract, sorry, I'm going on too much, but the monetary base, we have, $4 trillion now in monetary base, and it consists of nothing but ones and zeros. I mean, so what, it's the idea that now, I've got this brilliant new thing that's going to be
right,
digital.
The internet.
We're already there, Yeah.
Sad, really, to listen to people say this stuff. But, he clearly doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. He's wondering why we would need it. And he thinks that the interesting thing about it is the fact that it is digital. And it is not that is not the interesting thing about it. He's correct in that current monetary fiat money is digital. It is largely digital. It's the vast majority of it is digital. So the fact that Bitcoin is digital is really not what's interesting here. What's interesting is that it is automated. What's interesting is that it is run by proof of work rather than human judgment. What's interesting is that it is arrived at by consensus.
There's no coercion. It's purely consensus. It's 100% peaceful consensus. That's what's different about it. Not that it is digital. Anybody can make a digital currency. You can make one on your own Excel sheet. Just set up a Google Excel sheet with you and your friends and make a new digital currency on it. And there you go. The digital currency is not the interesting aspect. The aspect is that we've managed to make a currency that's digital work without having to have an authority that is in charge and without having to expand the supply. So the supply is fixed and it doesn't grow. So the supply is fixed, it doesn't grow, and that allows it to hold value much better over time. And that's what's interesting about it, and that's what's driving the price up. So the interesting thing here for people like Krugman to address is, at what price would you admit that Bitcoin works? There has to be a price, because at $100 million to a Bitcoin, that's it. You know, the dollar is most likely done. There will come a point at which the price has to make Bitcoin succeed, and these people just simply refuse to get it. They continue to think of the number of the price of Bitcoin, and it is I think an indictment of just how little they think of markets, in that they don't think of the number as meaning anything. They think of, just like, you know, in the stock market, they think that government can just make number go up by clicking the print button. And just like, you know, we can control unemployment and inflation and all of these things, they can all be managed and manipulated by government. They think that the market for Bitcoin is just fake numbers. It's just a number out there, but it is a real market where there's nobody manipulating. There's nobody able to make more supply or influence the price. There's nobody able to force anybody to accept it. So everybody accepts it consensually. And that's I think, the angle that they continue to miss. And of course, I'm not surprised that they miss it, because, you know, they're massively incentivized to miss it. Because let's face it, you know, these are economists that function and work with the fiat system and within the fiat system and to promote the fiat system. And so they're extremely motivated to believe and hold strong faith in the fiat system. So I'm not holding my breath, but I thought it would be worth mentioning that. Ken, you had something to say? No. Anybody else want to add anything on this? I'm going through the comments. Yeah, and of course, Max is saying they're comparing 2021 to 2017. So for them, you know, well, it got to 20 in 2017. So now 4 years later, it got to 30. So what's the difference? It's just numbers. But it's not just numbers. It means much more value stored in Bitcoin and held by people all over the world. And that's not a joke. That's a market choice. I mean, ultimately, I think the mind-blowing thing about Bitcoin is that as soon as it exists, as soon as Bitcoin starts working and it exists, the fact that the token itself has a market value is itself the value of the token itself is essentially a market in the monetization of Bitcoin. It's essentially the market pricing in the monetization of Bitcoin. And so basically it just becomes, you know, your opinion, the fact that Bitcoin doesn't work or shouldn't work or that it's worthless, it's only relevant as a market opinion. You're just saying that Bitcoin is overpriced. So you're basically short Bitcoin. You're saying Bitcoin at $30,000 or at $58 or at 17 cents is not worth it. It's going to drop, and it's not worth this amount. It's going to keep dropping further. If this is how you think about it, then that's just a market position. But Bitcoin's genius is that by making a market in it, then effectively it allows people to bet on it. And in effect, by betting on it, by creating the betting market on this, you're simply just providing the liquidity that allows for the monetization to take place. That's really, I think, the genius here, that a lot of the people, you know, Satoshi's line was, it might make sense to get some just in case it catches on.
that's really the way it is. And so effectively, you want to get some just because maybe if others choose to monetize it and then it catches on and then the fire is lit and the fire catches on, you know, you want to get yourself some of that fire. You want to be at the forefront of it, because otherwise, you know, everybody else will have all the fun. So that's really the incredible thing about how Bitcoin functions, in that it makes the market value of the currency a mechanism for people to express their faith in the currency. So the more people hear about Bitcoin and start to value it and want to give their some of their balance sheet to it, the more they are effectively voting for it in the market for currencies, in the market for things to be held in the balance sheet, in the market for value storage for the future. And so the more they do that, the more the Bitcoin is winning effectively in this market. And that's really the only way to think about it, because it's a fight out there for all of the world's investors' portfolios. And Bitcoin, the higher the price of Bitcoin goes up, that's the only way that Bitcoin adoption grows. It's effectively how we measure Bitcoin adoption. Bitcoin price is how we measure Bitcoin adoption, because it refers to how much Bitcoin cash balances are out there. Max?
All right. I just realized that when I wrote the comment on the chat, I made a mistake. The thing is, what I'm witnessing now is that people are comparing December 2017 with December 2020 because the prices are similar. And there is a major mistake. We should compare December 2017 with December 2021. We have to wait and see, because there is the halving factor. We just crossed the all-time high just the other day. So this comparison is absolutely nonsense. It ignores one of the core properties of Bitcoin. It's not just about the price alone. It's the whole mechanism, right?
Yeah, the fact that it has these four-year cycles is absolutely, I think, a vital part of it. And of course, it's why that no coiners are always beginning all of their charts from the all-time high. You know, all their comparisons and all their charts always begin from the all-time high. So they're, from December 2017 until now, Bitcoin has been down because it's until a few months ago, a few weeks ago. Bitcoin is still nowhere near where it was on December 2017. So this is a bubble and it's going to burst. It's unsustainable. It's going to burst. It's going to keep crashing. But they don't get it that, in fact, it's much more distribution and it's much more money being held by many more people all over the world for longer periods of time. So in December, we only had this amount of money for a few weeks and a few months. But now it's at it's being held up as a price for a much longer period, over $10,000. We've held up that period for a much longer time. So there's a lot more holders that are holding this kind of this asset, essentially. You want to say something, Max? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I made another mistake now. I guess the correct comparison would be December 2016.
I was going to say that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I made a mistake. Anyway, they are comparing the two tops. That's it.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Of course, that's how they and it's just basically a broken record that can't be stopped, because no matter what happens with Bitcoin, they can always say that it's a bubble, and they can always, you know, if it's rising, if it's exceeded the all-time high, then Bitcoin is a bubble and it's going to crash. And if it has dropped behind the all-time high, you know, we saw now Rubini is celebrating 29K. These people have absolutely no perspective on time and long-term views. You know, the fact that it dropped over the last 2 days essentially erases all of the rises that happened before it, because he's got the attention span of a goldfish, basically. Because, you know, in the long run, we're all dead, as all these Keynesians always remind us. So it's only about the last It's only about the last day and the last couple of days. So it's a broken record, and it's pointless. And these people are ridiculous. Which brings us to another bit of success and drama for the Bitcoin haters, which is today's announcement by the by the U.S. Office of the Comptroller of the Currency that they are going to allow U.S. banks to use public blockchains and dollar stablecoins as a settlement infrastructure in the U.S. financial system. And this, I think, is a hugely interesting development. Let me share the tweet that I saw just before we started recording from Jeremy Allaire. So effectively, banks can use public chains as infrastructure similar to SWIFT, ACH, Fedwire, and stablecoins as electronic stored value, which I think is a pretty big deal. And I think it's a pretty big deal first initially because of, for selfish reasons, I'll just say that this is another thing in which my book's analysis is vindicated. My book was one of the first that offered a statement of the idea that Bitcoin is not a payment network and it's not even necessarily a consumer network. Bitcoin is much more like a settlement network because it doesn't have the ability to scale enough for each individual to be able to put all of their transactions on chain. And so I looked at the economics of that in my book, The Bitcoin Standard, and I argue, Bitcoin does a few thousand transactions a day. If it were to scale to the level of transactions that Visa does, then you're not talking about the scaling problem where we need to 10x or 100x. You're talking about scaling problem where we're going to need to do maybe a million x compared to current capacity. And also, where given Bitcoin's very complicated consensus mechanism and all of that stuff, the ability to arrive at consensus becomes just almost unworkable at that level of transactions, because if you have much bigger blocks, then it becomes much harder to have a decentralized system. And that was really a key point in the Bitcoin Standard, which is that in order for Bitcoin to function, it needs to be decentralized. If it's decentralized, it has to have a low price for people to be able to run a node. Running a node in Bitcoin is what keeps Bitcoin decentralized. The reason the supply is hard to change is because a lot of people all over the world run their own nodes, and those people, they get to decide the monetary policy of the Bitcoin that they want to use. So because of this, in my mind, Bitcoin, if it were to be geared for efficiency and volume of transactions, then it would require an enormous amount of increase in capacity, which would require running a node to become much more expensive, which would lead to centralization. So if you wanted to make Bitcoin efficient for payments, the best thing you would do is you would centralize Bitcoin and turn it into Visa. But we already have Visa, and we already have PayPal, and we already have Venmo, and we already have all of these payment systems, and they can work on top of Bitcoin. That's really the key thing. What Bitcoin does is far more similar to large value settlement transactions. That's what Bitcoin really is able to do. And so we see this. And I think the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency is absolutely correct in this way of looking at it, because banks are not going to be, as an initial step at least, banks are not going to be using the Bitcoin network in order to clear individual payments. They're not going to have you get your paycheck delivered to you in Bitcoin and have your coffee sent to your neighbor using the Bitcoin network. They're going to be using this for settlement. They're going to be using it for the back end. So it's not a replacement for Visa. It's not a replacement for MasterCard or PayPal. It's a replacement for SWIFT, or it's a competitor for SWIFT, ACH, and Fedwire. And so that's that I think is very much up the alley of what I was arguing in my book. And I'm glad to see it headed in that direction. And I think this is a huge development for Bitcoin, because now banks can, and financial institutions in general, can accelerate their acceptance of Bitcoin, because, and their ability to hold Bitcoin, because there's far less ambiguity about the fact that you can use this infrastructure at this point. So I think this is enormously important news, and I think it's quite interesting. And this is, of course, an excellent measure of Bitcoin's success. The fact that this open source software is now treated on par with the infrastructure of the Federal Reserve banking system is, I think, an astounding achievement. The fact that the legal system, the regulatory bodies of the government come to accept it as being an acceptable substitute or complement, if you want, for government supervised and government built and operated systems, I think is quite outstanding. And it's an incredible mark of success. But of course, the altcoiners or the dollar coin enthusiasts and the bitter no coiners continue to find ways of trying to portray this stuff in a negative perspective. It's actually quite amazing. And so somebody, some anonymous account posted this response to me on Twitter when I posted this. I posted the announcement on Twitter and saying that this is similar to what I had discussed in my book. So somebody responds with the quote from economist David Andolfato, and he quote tweets the announcement and says, "Call me crazy, but I still cannot fathom why one would want to perform simple debit credit operations on a spreadsheet using the accounting services provided by miners playing a non-cooperative game with each other." And so, you know, again, it's the same kind of mentality that somebody like Nouriel Roubini has, which is, this doesn't make sense to me, so I'm going to just poke fun at it and call it stupid, because ultimately I can get away with it because I have a fake job that pays me a salary regardless of what I do, because I work in fiat. You know, there is no way that you can be wrong. There is no way that you can face consequences when you hold a job in fiat academia. So these economists like to make jokes about this. And so George Selgin, of course, responds and says, "Well, when you put it that way." And these two economists, you know, they've been following Bitcoin around for quite a while and have offered nothing but this kind of, you know, sitting there and just saying, "Well, it's not going to work because this doesn't make sense to me, and I have a lot of degrees, and if it doesn't make sense to me, then it's clearly not going to work, and you should listen to people who have more degrees than you." And essentially, it's just this endless stream of finding things to be negative about without really caring to think about this question with a clear mind. It's just, how do I misunderstand it? So you would think, like, if this was a startup, like if Bitcoin was a startup and it had managed to achieve this $500 billion market cap, or at least $500 billion assets under management, let's say, and it is operating a banking rails that is out there competing with Fedwire and ACH and Swift. If you had a startup actually managed to pull this off, you know, would people go around and say, "Why is this being done like that? Why?" You know, no, I think, you know, unless you're financed by the competitor of this startup, you would just simply think, "Well, that's a startup that succeeded." Like, you know, Apple has become a big company and they go around and they produce things and people buy it. There is an insistence on misunderstanding Bitcoin, on trying to find a way to portray it as if it's being negative. And so, you know, this guy posted this for me and I responded simply, you know,
why would one want to perform single debit credit operations or spreadsheet using the accounting services provided by miners playing a non-cooperative game with one another? It's very simple, because miners can't collude to inflate the supply, whereas a government-protected cartel of banks can. They also can't hire a mountain of midwit economists to keep DDoSing everyone from understanding what's going on by asking irrelevant, snarky, profound-sounding questions like this. This is really what fiat economists contribute to the discussion these days. It's a bunch of people looking around there and just standing there and saying, you know, but hang on a second. If Bitcoin is so smart, why doesn't it make sense to me on this thing? And, you know, all congratulating each other for finding something that doesn't make sense in Bitcoin for them, rather than trying to humbly ask themselves, why am I wrong? And could I be wrong? How could I be wrong? What could I say in order to revise this and make it less wrong? Or beginning by, let's say, setting a price. So we don't see that, of course. We continue to see this kind of refusal to dismiss, to think about it. And in this example, you know, it shows just how much they refuse to think about the value proposition of it. Well, yeah, actually, the fact that the miners are playing a non-cooperative game with each other is why we know that they can't easily collude. Whereas we know that in the only alternative that is available, it's very easy for banks to collude. They have an oligopoly. It is protected monopoly. It is a protected oligopoly which isn't open to free market competition. There is a monopoly for the currency, and it is possible for people who use the currency to have different preferences about what happens to the currency than the people who operate it. And that, you know, in that power struggle, the people who use the currency have to take whatever the people who operate the currency do, more or less. There's no market alternative that you can just get into. So Bitcoin brings this free market competition to the system, but these people don't like it. It's sad, but what are you going to do? This is really how no coiners are going to be always. I think it's amazing that there are so many people in the fiat academic system that are motivated for Bitcoin to fail, that they continue to sling so much mud at it. But fortunately, Bitcoin thrives on whatever people throw at it. Anybody have any thoughts on this?
It's quite amusing to see that many of those denials of reality coincide with the ones that criticize praxeology. They say, well, it's not connected to reality, it's just abstraction, a priori reasoning, and so on. And they're the ones sticking to whatever they have been believing for years, and they just refuse to see reality.
That's true. It's amazing. It really is. You'd think people who are empirical, who are always beating up on the Austrians for not being empirical enough, you know, you'd think they'd offer some kind of testable hypothesis for their ideas. But unfortunately, you can't really see that happening. Now, one other interesting aspect of this is, now that the USOC said banks use public blockchains and dollar stablecoins, if they're going to start saying that, well, now the word public blockchain has taken on extreme significance. What exactly is a public blockchain, and what counts as public blockchains? Because it's one thing to go around and say our blockchain is public and decentralized when you're, you know, you're saying it to a bunch of people on Twitter who are pumping and dumping your coin. It's one other thing when central banks and banks are considering using your public blockchain for settling payments amongst one another. Then, you know, the bar to clear in order to call yourself a public blockchain becomes becomes much higher. So it'll be very interesting to see how this develops, because I think, I mean, to be fair, at this point, it's very clear that the institutional push in cryptocurrencies has been almost entirely about Bitcoin. So no corporations are talking about using shitcoins or holding on to shitcoins. They're experimenting with blockchain technology, but nobody's holding shitcoins on the balance sheet. I mean, nobody is a big word. I'm sure there's somebody somewhere. But nobody outside of the shitcoin industrial complex, I would say, holds shitcoins on their balance sheet. So it could be that, you know, Bitcoin continues to take the lead in this, and then shitcoins don't get much action in this regard. But if they do, I can imagine an entire can of worms being opened in terms of litigation and regulators going after people, because if the thing is being used as a public blockchain and then you get a hack and your friends want to roll back the blockchain in order to cancel the hack, as we've seen certain shitcoins do, if this does end up happening and you end up accidentally canceling $500 million of Bank of America holdings with your hard fork, there will be, I think, more serious implications than just doing this for you and your friends on Twitter. It opens up a big can of worms for stable coins and for Bitcoins and for shitcoins to prove that they are decentralized. I think Bitcoin effectively is the gold standard here, or the Bitcoin standard, to borrow a phrase. Is the Bitcoin standard of decentralization, in that it's clearly the most decentralized. Nobody controls it. Nobody can change anything. Nobody can hard fork it. Nobody can change consensus rules. Nobody can change the money supply. It's the most decentralized and the most secure. And arguably, in my mind, it is the only one that's decentralized. So the rest now are going to be put to the test of, A, are you actually decentralized? And B, so can you legally pass for being decentralized? And can you actually handle the heat of running a settlement network when it's not decentralized, if it is not decentralized? In other words, you're going to reach points where you have to make decisions, and these decisions will involve winners and losers. And so if people are in this network able to make decisions, then it's going to, if they have the ability to make decisions, then that makes their situation tenuous. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch the entire space start getting taken more seriously, because it's going to put a lot of them under the test. Stable coins, I think, I mean, ultimately, it's fun to say stable coins are decentralized, but, and this is where I disagree with the guy making this thread that, they're saying this is a huge win for stable coins. It could be, but it could also be the poisoned chalice, if you want, in that this ends up putting them on the spot, forcing them to make expensive decisions and purchases, and putting them in politically sensitive, having to make politically sensitive decisions that will then carry ramifications. So, there will be a transaction by criminals or terrorists or whatever on one of these stable coins. And, courts want you to confiscate the material. So, do you not confiscate it when you have the ability to confiscate it, or to the payment? If you don't confiscate it, then you could become legally liable. So, but then if you confiscate it, then is it really decentralized, and is it a public blockchain? It'll be interesting to see. In general, the way that I look at it, I don't particularly think that stable coins can make a lot of sense in the long run, because if you want to offer payments in the dollar, then you're going to have to be holding a bunch of dollars, and you're going to have to need access to the dollar payment system. You're going to need access to the dollar rails, and other, you know, you have to hold dollars in order to make a market in your currency. And so basically all stablecoins can, in my mind, be cut off from the banking rail. And it could take something drastic, you know, shutting down large banks or prosecuting large banks. But I think when people talk about the kind of scenarios that are needed to take down Bitcoin, I think it's, if you apply that kind of analysis toward stablecoins, they'll be, it'll be far easier to take them down. But we'll see. I'm open to the possibility that they continue to proliferate as a kind of cryptographic way of settling dollar payments. But the political problem, I think, that they run into ultimately is, you know, they're going to be limited in what they can do by the fact that they're connected to the dollar system. And then in the Bitcoin world, they're going to be limited by the fact that they cannot offer number go up technology. Basically, the stable coins are stuck to the dollar, and that doesn't appreciate as much as Bitcoin. So it doesn't quite offer many advantages. I can see the use cases for many people, but I'm not very optimistic about the chances in the long run. I think it might be the case that this kind of law, well, this is not a law, this is guidance, but this kind of guidance would actually lead to more Bitcoin win, basically, because it just makes Bitcoin become more recognized as the only one that's reliable, that's neutral, that's stable technically. So just like everything that happens under the sun, this too is good for Bitcoin. And aren't we glad for that? Yeah. What do you guys think?
I just wonder, back to the question of why people don't like Bitcoin or don't want to like Bitcoin, because it seems like it's more that they don't want to, people don't want it to succeed. And, but I wonder if it has to do with their sense of time, that in Keynesian economics, or the way the system has been for so long, it works the same way over and over and over and over. And in that sense, it's pretty reliable. If you know to expect it to behave that way. And as we know, change is happening faster and faster, and the faster, you know, like really faster. And Bitcoin, the change that's happening within Bitcoin is really fast. And maybe they just can't keep up with, like, they don't trust how quickly that it's changing, you know, that the NGU, that it can't sustain, that can't be possible. It has to be a bubble because the time frame doesn't work. I guess Tonvase was talking about this too a little bit, and I don't know, I don't really claim to understand it, except that one of his objections, right, was he wanted to see a time frame for Bitcoin to stabilize before he could trust it. Did I get that right?
I'm not so sure he was mentioning that. I think he's pretty much already very much taken the orange pill and trusted it.
Yeah, for sure. But I thought he had talked about it, time frame. But anyway, I think the people who object to it want to see it. It's like, oh, this is happening too fast. This can't happen this fast. But things are happening this fast, and they're happening faster all the time. So get with the program.
Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely. And I think a very important point that Michael Saylor makes, which I think is one of the very profound additions that he has given to the discussion around Bitcoin, is wait, which one was it? I forgot. Oh crap.
When he was with us in class in the seminar?
I think so. What was your point? Why did I lose my train of thought?
Well, it's just the time that things are happening so fast.
Yes, and the network stuff. Yes.
Up with that, the increase of speed. Because even as the speed is getting faster, the speed of the speed is getting faster.
Yeah. Yeah, the insight was the one that I wanted to bring up is that Bitcoin has reached a certain size of a network where it is, it's essentially unbeatable. It's reached the point where these networks just simply can't be stopped. And I think he wrote this in a book, which he mentioned in the seminar when he came and spoke here a few weeks ago, and he's going to be back in a couple of weeks for another one. He spoke about the theory of behind his book, The Mobile Wave, was that all of these physical services are going to get de-physicalized, turned from being physical into being digital, and they're going to be put into these apps. These apps are going to take away a big part of the physical experience of what is going on in your life. And he said that these forces are unstoppable because the growth in productivity that they offer over the alternative is enormous, and it's just going to continue to grow. And once one of these has reached the threshold of $100 billion in market value being held in this network, once this network is viewed to be worth $100 billion, and it is much bigger than its second competitor, nearest competitor, then it's game over. You know, that network is just going to continue to grow and eat more into the physical infrastructure that it replaces because the productivity increases are enormous. And it's just going to continue to attract more people because the productivity gain from joining it will absolutely trump the angry rhetoric from sitting on the sidelines. And so, he mentions the example of Amazon and Apple, you know, the fact that Apple could get rid of so much out of your life by putting it on a phone, and Amazon can get rid of so much of your shopping by putting it on a website where you just have it delivered home, and Netflix can get rid of so much of your entertainment infrastructure instead of you having to go to a cinema or a theater or a DVD place or all of that. You just click a button and watch at home. So all of these things, and Facebook dematerialized a lot of our social life where, you know, instead of having to go and meet people IRL, you sit in your bug pod and have a social life online. And for better or worse, it grows because this is just a far more efficient way of doing it. I mean, of course, we can complain about those things, but the reality is that, you know, social media allows people to meet a much larger number of people, to interact, to sift through one another and to sort each other out and find interests, common interests, and so on. It's just people end up using it because it offers these things in a much more efficient way. And Bitcoin's like that. Bitcoin takes away central banks and payment settlement networks and all of these gigantic physical infrastructure, literal physical infrastructure. There are banks and payment networks and so on, and takes away the human judgment element of it. Instead of having committees out there deciding who gets to issue loans and who does not, and at what interest rate and what the money supply is, instead of having all of that, you end up with just having individuals actually taking charge of the network through nodes running all over the world and mining infrastructure that's decentralized. It's just an infinitely more efficient way of doing things. And once it crossed the $100 billion mark, and that's really been the case in Bitcoin's case, that has been the case for Bitcoin for pretty much most of the last 4 years. I think we dropped below the $100 billion mark in the 4 years, but it spent most of the last 4 years, I would say, over the $100 billion mark, and now is at around 500. I think once this has happened, I think Saylor is really onto something very profound in that the lock-in effect of having a network of this magnitude displacing something physical just makes it almost inevitable. And this is this was his thesis in his book, and this is why Bitcoin clicked so much with him. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting things that he's lenses that really that he's given us to analyze and understand Bitcoin. Anybody else have any other questions or comments to add today? All right, well, thank you guys for joining. It was fun. And for Thursday's seminar, we're going to have, we're going to be discussing my book, Principles of Economics. I've written 3 chapters that have been sent out to subscribers so far, and I urge you to subscribe. And if you're listening and you're not subscribed, I urge you to subscribe and start reading the chapters. It's very fun. And I'm going to be discussing the first 3 chapters in our seminar on Thursday. So those of you who have read it, please come. Please send me questions beforehand, comments, and come prepared with more questions so we can discuss it on in Thursday's seminar. And then next Monday's seminar, we're going to have Preston Pish join us to talk more Bitcoin. So thank you for joining, and I will see you then.